Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, before we get the show started, I wanted to let you know we are giving away a bunch of brand new Black Magic gear.
Yeah, cameras, switchers, DaVinci Resolve licenses, a bunch of awesome stuff. So stay tuned to learn how you can enter to win free gear from Black Magic, and we're going to tell you all about it later on in this episode. Now cue the music.
Hey, welcome to the 220th episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. This episode is brought to you by patron Peter Spriet. I'm Matt Enlow.
And I'm Oren Kaplan, and today we have director Kabir Akhtar on the podcast. He has directed and edited many of our favorite shows, and we do have a crazy ex-girlfriend, Nut, hosting this podcast.
Yeah, I do love that show. And also his current show, Never Have I Ever, which is out on Netflix now, which is so great.
Yeah, I'm like mad at my wife because I'm like, can you please watch the first three episodes so we can watch the fourth
together?
Oh, so
you can catch up? Yeah.
And then the next day I'm like, can you please watch the first four episodes so we can watch the fifth one? I think I'm on like seven or something, but I'm trying to like go really slow, but it's so good, right?
Yeah, we recorded this episode kind of a while ago now, and basically the next day after we recorded with Kabir, my wife and I finished it. It was like popcorn. You're just going so fast.
It's got a tone that can you think of any other show that has that same tone?
I mean, I think that there's a world where you can compare it with Sex Education, where it's got like a little bit of a meta thing to it of like, it's a little throwbacky, it's a little 80s, a little 90s, intentionally so. But I think that, especially with Never Have I Ever, it's got like an updated sensibility, basically, that was really fun. It's like totally universal and specific all at once, which is exactly what you want out of a comedy or any storytelling in general. So yeah. Well done, Kabir.
It's a good point. Yeah, it's like American Pie, but done in a cool, modern...
Sure, or any John Hughes movie or whatever, or like, you know, it's got Babysitter's Club vibes, but also is like not tired or lame in the way that sometimes those cliches can be. You know, like it's still about the people who want to connect with each other and figure out how to grow up together and all of that stuff, but it's in a really fun, fresh way, and the joke writing is super strong, as you would expect from a Mindy Kaling show.
The other awesome thing that we talk about in this interview is just how Kabir was an editor, and he used Matt's famous be in the building method to become a director on all these TV shows, and it's great to hear like a really specific example of how to get to direct TV that way.
The other thing that really struck me about the conversation with Kabir is that, you know, this is a guy who's like nominated for a bunch of awards. He's directing every show that like I would love to have this dude's career. It's like, he's just crushing it nonstop. But the thing that we learn, the big takeaway besides editing is important and being in the building, is that the grind never stops. Kabir is constantly out meeting people, talking with people, raising his profile, helping other people,
like going on podcasts,
genuinely, right? But
networking,
like the networking part of it is still a big part of the job, and that doesn't go away.
Yeah, and we've spoken to so many TV directors at this point that like it is quite evident that if you want to be a TV director and you want to make that your career, you need to meet a lot of people, not just other directors, not just writers. Mm-hmm. Not just network executives, but everyone, producers, DPs, editors. It's just, It's an ecosystem that you have to plug yourself into. It's not like you just show up with like an amazing short film and you get picked up.
Yeah. Yeah. So really wonderful takeaways. Kabir's super funny and really engaging. And so it's a great conversation.
Yeah. Before we talk to Kabir, I just wanted to remind people we have a Patreon page. We are potentially nearing the end of the first wave of this COVID pandemic. Who knows? Who knows what's going on? But there are a lot of places that have opened back up and quite scarily. But yeah, maybe if you're back at work, you feel like you get something from the podcast and you want to throw us a dollar a month or something, go for it. If not, no worries. But we love our patrons and you are what kind of fuel us to keep going, because we know that people care about the podcast and feel like they're getting something out of it. So thanks for that. You can go to patreon.com/justshootitpod to learn more.
And if you're not a Patreon type, if you just want to get a little bit of swag, but without the recurring small incremental fees, you could always just buy a t-shirt. We have a new store up. We've got a bunch of awesome designs, your classic Just Shoot It logos, but also a few listener designed t-shirts as well. They get a decent portion of that money, but also like if you want it, but we also get a little bit as well, which is pretty cool, all through TeePublic. It's all print on demand, so it's pretty rad. I myself have a validation t-shirt that's like basically like festival laurels, but instead of what festival it's from, it just says validation three times, and I get compliments on it,
which is weird because you only got into two validation festivals.
That's true. Yeah,
you put three laurels on your shirt.
it's slightly confusing, but it's actually the same validation festival twice. So
okay, and how do people find those? justshootitpodcast.com, and then they click on the store link.
Yep, and I believe actually justshootitpod.com/store will get you there as well.
Well, with that, let's talk to Kabir.
Hey, folks, we're interrupting this incredible episode of the podcast to tell you about a new sponsor that we're working with, Front Row Insurance Brokers. One of the challenges of being a filmmaker is that there's a lot of risks that we take, and we really just want to focus on making good stuff. So what if there was a company that could take those risks, manage them for us while we are being artists?
That's right. Front Row Insurance Brokers arranges film production insurance to cover the risks associated with your production. They cover features, TV shows, documentaries, commercials, music videos, webisodes, basically anything you can watch on big, medium or phone-sized screens.
Yeah, Front Row will help you focus on your artistic vision by transferring all the risks to them and minimizing your production hazards. And they cover any budget from $2,000 all the way up to $200 million. There's nothing that's too small or too big.
If you are shooting in Canada, use coupon code JUSTSHOOTIT50OFF for $50 off your film production insurance. That's promo code JUSTSHOOTIT50OFF to save $50.
And if you're shooting in the U.S., that same code can be redeemed offline by mentioning it to a broker, by email, or over the phone.
It's like a cool password if you're in the U.S. That's Just Shoot It 50 Off.
Check them out. Let us know how it goes. Okay, we're here with Kabir. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, guys. Thanks for having me.
So you have directed and edited many TV shows that we all love, including the newest show on Netflix that Matt and I have just watched, Never Have I Ever.
I'm not exaggerating. I was almost late to this recording because we were watching it.
It's funny. It sounds like you were saying that you were late because you needed to catch up and watch it for this podcast, not because you were enjoying it so much.
No. We'd done our homework already, and then my wife and I were like, oh, well, we should keep watching, and then just got sucked in. That binge watch culture, man. Mission accomplished.
Thanks. Especially, I mean, it's funny because it's a weird thing to have a show come out now. On the one hand, I feel like normally you'd see the cast doing talk shows or other press appearances, or we would have had like a premiere party or whatever.
Well, I think that it satisfies a very specific vacuum in TV right now. There's not a ton of feel-good, fun, engaging, relatable comedies out there.
I mean, you can't control for these kinds of things. We shot this show in the fall. Mm-hmm. I mean, I literally was shooting these episodes starting in August, which I'd been on to, I think, 5 other gigs since then.
Wait, how many TV episodes have you directed in the last year?
Well, I don't know. 12-ish?
Well, look, let's back up just a little bit, right? Because, Kabir, I think you've got a wonderful resume that's worth talking through. You started as an editor, right? So tell us about how you got that first major editing gig.
I mean, like, when I first moved here in a million years ago, 98, I had come out of film school and the plan was, well, whatever happens first, a PA job or an editing job, I'll take it. Because it's so dumb.
You could have been the best first AD in the business by now.
Yeah. It's wild because I really just kind of thought, well, the goal since the beginning was to be directing, I don't know, brand name or high budget or whatever, just cool, fun narrative content. And from the very beginning, it's hard to know how you even get there. I always tell people now, like, try to land as close as you can to the kind of work you want to be doing. Meaning if you want to be working in features or TV, or obviously it's very easy to get pigeonholed and hard to wiggle around from column to column right before you start moving up. But I wish someone had told me that. My first job was editing. Me and my then roommate, who we were editing business partners for years, was editing a little music video clip show for a network that went out of business. But within a year, one of those producers that I met there called me and she was like, hey, I'm producing an episode of Behind the Music. Mm-hmm. And she's like, I've fired two or three editors off this show already. And we have like a week left till this thing airs and the cut is a mess. And if you want to come in, you can have. I remember I turned around after I got this call and she was like, it starts tomorrow. And I remember turning around to the producer I was working with and saying, today is going to be my last day. Because, there's some jobs you have to take. I've been working this little company, this little upstart that wasn't, it was clearly going nowhere. This was the place it was going. Sure. And Behind the Music was such a hit show at the time. I always tell people now that sometimes people are on job A and then they get a call about job B. And like, should I do it or should I not do it? And I'm like, well, there's obviously every case is different. You got to consider whether you're going to burn the bridge or not, whether there'll be consequences with the ups and downs. But on a sliding scale, I always say, for example, if you got a call tomorrow, someone said, hey, would you like to come and direct the next Star Wars movie? Mm. The answer is yes. You will quit your job and you're going to go do the Star Wars movie. So it's just somewhere between here and there. Where is it? Right?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's interesting having a lot of good friends who are editors. It is kind of a long-term gig. Once you end up in those shows that have their own life cycle and their own kind of community of people, right? Like, ideally, a network TV show, they're pretty lucrative. They're pretty long-term. And it's a little hard to know whether or not your show is going to get picked up for the next season or not. And so deciding to jump ship can be a pretty significant decision because it could really burn that bridge. And who knows how long the new show is going to last for, you know what I mean?
Oh my God. I mean, the biggest and best career decision I made in, I've been doing this now 20 years, was to jump ship at some point. I mean, I've obviously jumped ship a lot. I mean, the whole front end of my career was built on going from here to there, to there, to there, to there, and so on. Because the places that I was working at the beginning, they were paychecks, and I was having fun doing it. But it wasn't what I wanted to do.
But were you learning to become a better editor?
It was an incredible training ground. I mean, like, 20-something-year-old me was really cocky and was like, this is fine. Guys, get out of the way. Let me show you how this is going to be done. Here's how we're going to make this show. But even from the very beginning, I used to just say, turn around and say to the producers in the room, they'd be like, you've got this footage and none of it goes together. None of it tells the story the way you want it to or does what you want it to. And if you had had me shoot it, then this wouldn't be a problem.
You really would say that?
Absolutely.
Then you would recommend people say?
Like, I don't recommend that anyone do anything I've done. I feel like it's use at your own risk. I don't know that it was always well received, but I was working consistently as a freelancer from the first few months, and I think it's because I was very good at what I was doing. At least I was coming with a strong point of view. It was not always a point of view that meshed well with a show creator, a producer that I was working with. But I mean, if you don't have a point of view, I mean, what are we even doing at all, right?
Right, as an editor, you're saying even.
Well, any of us is an editor for sure. I mean, editor, director, it doesn't matter what you're doing. I mean, no matter what your creative role is on a show, it's all about having a perspective. Otherwise, if you're easily replaceable with somebody else, it means you're not bringing enough of your own point of view to it or some creative contribution that is uniquely yours. And that's why people get hired. That's why people hire all of us.
And so is that you? That's even true if you're coming in to edit episode 7 of season 3 of Mad Men.
Vital. Whatever. Vital. I mean, absolutely.
Because the rhythms and the angles and the kind of cinematic language have been established. And obviously they're being tweaked season by season. And a new DP does this and a director. But in general, there are guides, right? And sometimes are there situations where you're like, ooh, this would be fun if we did this crazy quick montage here. And someone's like, no, we don't do that.
No, I think, but you're right as far as shows having their own language. But it's like the English language. I mean, there are rules and we can all craft sentences that sound like we said them, the way I talk, the way you talk, all this. We all are just doing our own thing. We are still operating within the parameters of an established language here in a verbal language, but also within a cinematic language. I mean, I used to go in on shows, all kinds of shows, and just do one episode, 2 weeks, half of an episode of something before I was able to crack into working in scripted, big name scripted shows.
Well, actually, on that note, I'm curious, do you think as a director on episodic TV on a show like A Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, who do you think has more creative input on an episode, the director or the editor?
Oh, I think it varies because you're having different inputs in different ways. I haven't been editing now for a couple years. And editor me would always used to say, I mean, and this is the advice I would give directors when they would show up on shows. And I still believe this now as a director full time, that it's not the director's show, it's the editor's show, right?
Yeah.
I mean, editor, when I was cutting a show, I mean, I'd be there all season, let's say, and a director would be there for 2 weeks and then gone.
And how has your perspective changed now that you're directing full time? Do you feel like you have more ownership than maybe the editor version of yourself gave a director credit for?
I don't know. I'm aware of what I'm doing. I know that I'm bringing a lot every second of the day on set. I mean, obviously, it's such a dynamic and fast-moving environment. There is constantly stuff happening, and there's the smallest turn left, turn right, so you've got to just decide on and keep moving. Plus, just the creative contributions you're making in terms of shot selection and performance shaping and all this. But ultimately, when you're sort of freelancing on different episodic series, you're not there to make your movie. Right?
You're the guest in there.
I mean,
the great
advice that I was given long ago, and I can't claim credit for it, but it's really smart. Two things. One was, you show up on a series, and they hand you a piece of paper with a circle on it, and they say, go color in this circle however you like. Just bring us back a circle. And the other thing was, for episode people wanting to get into episodic directing, I'm glad I heard this before I started doing it, was that you show up, you really, especially your first one, man, it's exciting. Something that you work for a long time, and it takes a lot of convincing a lot of people to get the opportunity and, not fuck it up. There's a lot of pressure, and you're really excited about it, and you show up on that first day, and you're just pumped. And for everybody else there, it's just Monday.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, even on an indie feature, though, I feel like there is that thing, and we talk about it on the podcast a lot, where it's like the director is like, this is my big opportunity. I got $100,000 from this person and $20,000 from this person, and we got this movie, and it's going to be awesome, and we're going to kill ourselves to get this done and jump off bridges and everything. And the rest of the crew is like, dude, this is your movie. I'm not jumping off a bridge.
No, absolutely. I think that I have seen lots of directors run into trouble coming in like that.
I think that's maybe one of the gifts of being a freelancer in episodic, right? Is that odds are pretty good there's going to be a few other jobs coming around the corner. Do you know what I mean? So it's not quite so do or die, whereas an indie feature that you've spent 3 years fundraising for and 5 years writing, the stakes just feel a lot higher. And so crew member, because that is their livelihood, it's definitely a different sort of energy that they're bringing to the set, right?
Well, I mean, yeah, that's why I never did it. truly, I think that there's so much respect. There's a lot of friends who've gone out and made their indie movies that way. But I mean, it's hats off to those people. I'm not built for that, for going out and finding the funding. And then, I mean, that's tough.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so let's talk about that transition that you made from editing full time to what's that first kind of big TV show that you directed?
Well, again, I think it comes in sort of steps. I found that when I discussed this with people who are interested in the sort of small details, I found for years, read these articles or interviews or Wikipedia about someone whose career you are really into or someone whose work you hope to emulate or admire or whatever, and it always says the same thing. It always says that they started off this, and then in 2011, they got their big break to direct this movie.
Sure.
And you're like, what? Wait, you just skipped the entire story.
We should make a podcast about that.
That's the stuff, especially for people who are trying to advance career-wise. All of us, me included, I was doing this for a long time before I was able to get to a plateau where I feel like, okay, good, things are really on solid ground in a different way now.
It's something we've heard from, we have a lot of good friends that edit a lot of TV and are also directors and have directed their own things but not really broken into TV. And they've tried to, on occasion, say, hey, I'll edit your pilot or I'll edit on your show if you give me an episode. Is that a type of thing that ever came into your orbit?
Yes. Yes, it is. It is, for sure. And again, like I said, even from the very beginning, tapping on people's shoulders, asking for a shot to go shoot something, it was mostly like, your footage is messed up. Have me shoot it. It won't be a problem. And I weirdly, incredibly, started meeting with some people who'd be like, okay, go shoot this thing. You can shoot this part of this thing. Come on set, and we're going to be out in the field shooting this concert or shooting this...
A second unit or a pickup day or something?
Yeah, I wish it was on anything that high budget or fancy, but it was literally grab a camera and contribute. We're going to pay you basically zero to do it. And I was like, great, just to have the opportunity and just to get the experience. Because, I mean, it's hard to be in a situation where you're learning on the job when the stakes are really high. I've definitely seen this happen to people where they have gotten big opportunities before they were ready, which is like, I'm not trying to be judgy about people saying, well, you're not ready for this. But just in terms of the preparedness that goes in, like, in a very broad way, it's not just enough to be like, well, I know what shots I'm going to use. And I like, just you know, how to be able to speak to certain producers about certain things and where the pressure points are, what you know, bears not to poke and so on.
So you were getting these small directing opportunities on reality, unscripted stuff.
Yeah, I was. And were they calling them directing? Not really. I was out shooting like small bits with like one person and just trying to create whatever I could. But
basically, you were just saying, like, oh, this is reality stuff. I know there are going to be some story beats I need to hit. I can go shoot this and kind of be a utility player in that way.
Yeah. And
know that you have the pieces you need, basically.
Exactly. Because, I mean, ultimately, it's about pieces. I've said this many times, but editing is like cooking and directing is like shopping for ingredients.
That's interesting.
Having been on the cooking end for like 20 years, of getting ingredients from people, you get a lot of ingredients that don't go together, and I had a lot of practice.
What's an example of like something that doesn't go? Like continuity isn't matching, or lighting, or
yeah, cilantro in a pie is kind of.
Yeah,
weird.
I was saying chocolate and onions is the thing I talk about now. Yeah. Delightful. I think they sell that at the Alcove. Yeah, I don't know. It's oftentimes in coverage, shots that don't go together. Look, it takes a lot of work. You have ideas when you're shooting to like set up a shot and it's going to be the specialty thing and you're going to do this. And it doesn't always make it into the cut because the producers don't always like it or it's not always right or whatever.
It's hard to get off a specialty shot that doesn't call attention to itself as being a specialty shot, right?
Well, I think that's kind of the fun, is trying to find a way that doesn't make it look like you're trying to find a way to make it look like something, right? You know, you don't want to be like all peacocking around, being like, look at me, look at this dope thing I did that has nothing to do with the style of what you're trying to shoot or telling the story in an effective way. Yeah, I mean, it happens. Sometimes they don't get in there. But I was on the receiving end a lot of times of footage that just did not cut together.
Right.
Even though it's cool.
So what's interesting to me about that is that I'm sure you've been in situations where, as an editor, you fixed that, right? And then the director, like, he's maybe like, ah, man, Kabir didn't even use the shot I wanted. We spent all day on that shot.
Uh-huh.
But then they continue to work, right? And what ends up happening is like, you're pigeonholed as the editor who can solve all these problems, right? And that director is a director who does really great work. And you're both in the buckets that you're in, and you're stuck editing and they're happy directing. How did you make that leap out? Like, tell us, what was that first TV show?
You have to edit bad. You have to edit poorly.
Sure. Well, because generally,
make other directors look bad.
It is a thing that's people get pigeonholed, right?
For sure. There's a long answer to this, and just shut me up when this gets too boring, because it's real. It can get really detailed, but I'll try
to go for it. Okay. Yeah, let's do it.
But again, this is, I think, the part of those articles that people always skip past.
That's what the show is about. Let's hear it. Yeah.
So after 7 years of editing for some people, I had started editing for a guy who was extremely helpful career-wise, a very smart, talented guy who was directing movies and episodic and also reality, who was sort of doing it all. And I got a shot to cut a pilot for him just because I was in the building cutting a reality show for him. And he replaced the editor who was on it. And he basically just walked down the hall and was like, do you want to cut this scripted thing we're doing? It was a cable half-hour pilot. And I was like, oh my God, of course. Are you kidding me?
And are you in the editor's union at this point?
No, I was not. I don't think it was a union show at the time. And I think still you can cut up to 30 days of a non-union or 30 days of a union project, but not be in
without joining. Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Which I didn't. I mean, there's a lot of this is again really detailed, but it was stuff I wish I had known. You know.
No, but that stuff is like, a lot of times. I guess a non-union editor would think, well, they'll never hire me for this job because I'm not in the union.
Yeah, and it's important to realize that that is not always true. There's a lot of gray area with some of these things that I think people can use to their advantage in order to be able to advance career-wise, and also in order to be able to learn and get better on lower budget projects. Anyway, that show, it went great. It did not get picked up, which is fine. So I did that a couple years later. Not even, actually, it was that same year. The director, we were at a mix for that pilot, and he mentioned to me that there was a series on Comedy Central that he was helping consult. I think he was consulting on it. And they needed a director to shoot a short film for it, like every week, two-minute thing. And it was a union gig, and he offered to refer me over there because he knew that directing was where I was trying to get to.
And
really,
you were kind of like comedy guy too?
It had kind of happened. Yeah, I'd sort of fallen in with those people. I wish I had known at the beginning, but it turned out that it's something I really loved. I mean, I always loved it, but
sure.
I was excited about the opportunity. I was like, yeah, absolutely. Are you kidding me? I will totally do that. And it was funny because I went to that meeting and it went great. And at the end of the meeting, they're like, by the way, you're in the Directors Guild, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Now, I had also learned a few months prior to this because I had had a, you know, similar, was able to get a meeting on a Comedy Central show to direct a short film every week. And meeting went great. And they were at the end of it, they're like, by the way, you're in the DGA, right? And I was like, fuck, I'm not. And they're like, oh, man, that's too bad. We were, oh. And I was like, oh. And I went home and I was sad. And like a week or two later, I called the DGA and I was like, hey, how do I get in? How does that work? And they're like, well, as a director, you have to have one DGA credit to get in. And I was like, oh, okay. Well, because I told them the situation and they're like, oh, that one can be your one.
That would be it, yeah.
So I called them to be like, I called the show back and I was like, hey guys, actually, I totally, it's fine. I'm totally in the union now. This is fine. They're like, we've hired somebody else. It's been 2 weeks. What's wrong with you?
No.
Yeah.
It was called Homeland.
Can you imagine? Star Wars. It was actually Star Wars. So then when this director offered to put me onto this Comedy Central show a few months later, and they said in that meeting, are you in the DJ? I was like, yes. And I immediately filled out the paperwork. I got hired, and that was my first one. And then I was directing a bunch of those sort of short comedies for a while, short comedy stuff for Comedy Central or MTV or Spike or whoever it was. And then again, a few years later, I was editing a show for Tracy Ullman, who was awesome. And when I met with her about the job, she and her husband, who has since passed away, but he was producing, they mentioned that they were doing a show, they were making a show, a half-hour comedy in India, like a British half hour. They're gonna shoot the whole thing on location in India. And I was like, oh my god. And again, like, things that I don't recommend you say to people, but I was like, you know who would be the perfect director for that show? And they're like, oh my god, who? I was like, me. Which is like a thing. I mean, I was meeting them about editing their show.
Yeah, so you were not hired yet?
No, not at all. I just walked, I'd met them like 10 minutes prior. But they hired me to edit their show, and then after a couple of weeks they offered me two episodes of that show that was a British primetime half hour called Mumbai Calling.
So did you have to pitch on it or anything, or like make it a lookbook?
No, I mean, it was a series that they were already doing. They just wanted someone to come in and do a couple episodes. And so I was like, great, they offered me episode like 2 and 4.
Wait, so did they watch your other directing reel or anything?
I think we just worked together for 2 weeks. And this is where I think one of those big, you mentioned this earlier too, but how much of the value of just being in the building and having the relationship was such a critical component. Because if you're looking to hire someone and two people come in off the street that are, let's say, equally qualified, are you going to hire the one you have worked with before and understand that they are in a creative space and in an interpersonal space that you, A, think is right for your show, and B, that you can just be around and collaborate creatively together? Mm-hmm. Or are you going to hire the stranger?
Right. Well, yeah. I guess something that I always think about is when, and I'm sure this happens to you, Matt, too, when I'm sometimes up for a job that's kind of a step up for me, like a little bit of a stretch for me to get, and I start saying, okay, oh, this is for ABC or something. This is for Netflix. Let me see who I know at Netflix. Let me see who I know at ABC.
Sure.
Let me start. And I'll find all these connections to executives or producers, you know, just through Facebook or LinkedIn or whatever. But they're connections just through friends, like a friend of a friend. It's not anyone that can vouch for me as a director, no one that is familiar with my work and is like, oh, Oren's a great director. Oren's super creative. Oren has a great eye. Oren's amazing with actors. So I do sometimes wonder if the connections that you need to have with people, I guess in my mind, I feel like they're going to hire you as a director. They would want to see how you direct. But is that not necessarily your experience?
I have found that to be the least true thing,
honest. TV is a funny thing like that, right? I think, Oren, you're kind of coming at it for, you were about to ask, like, oh, do you ever do treatments or lookbooks or a rip-o-matic or anything?
That's pitching, especially.
Pitching, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think it's because in the commercial world, we're so frequently strangers to the creative agency. Like maybe they've worked with a handful of people here or there, but for the most part, and there's always three directors who are all pitching against one another.
So or like even if we're not strangers,
arms race.
Right? Sometimes they'll be, oh, you did this awesome comedy thing, but we're doing a car thing with kids, so that's not, you don't know how to do that.
Completely.
And you have to re-pitch yourself, and they're like, well, we have this great director. She does cars amazing. And you're like, yeah, but we know each other.
It's been a while since I've talked about it on the show, but so Kabir, just for your reference, I used to work at Comedy Central for 5 years or whatever. And so every once in a while I'd be in a meeting and we'd be brainstorming, oh, who should direct this thing? And a couple people would just name their favorite people.
Yes.
Their favorite directors.
Absolutely.
That's maybe they'd pull out their phone or scroll through IMDb every once in a while. But for the most part, it was just like, off the top of my head. Okay, well, like, Kabir's great. Oren's great. So-and-so's on the Amy Schumer show, so we shouldn't ask him. They would just rattle off a few names, and would be the list you're working off with.
But then why would Kabir get it over Oren?
Because my last name starts with an A, and I think when people look at lists, I come first.
Yeah, or like two people know Kabir and one person knows Oren. You know what I mean?
Zoom out really far and remember that we're all freelancers. friend of mine said this to me once, I mean, forever ago, and it stuck with me. We're all getting hired on a whim, in a way. Qualifications, yeah. Experience, style of work, whatever all these things are, personality. But ultimately, none of those things matter if you're not actually on someone's list. I mean, you get a call or an email from some friend who's looking to like, hey, we have this show and we're looking for a, you know, we need an editor for the show starting next week. Do you know anyone who's available? Okay. Right. So if I've heard from some friend recently, then I'll be like, if I'm just driving and I get this, you know what I mean? Like, I get this call.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, oh, yeah, well, Matt's available. You know, I just talked to him. I know he's looking for a thing or whatever. But now if you and I haven't spoken recently and I don't know and I just assume that you're busy, like, you don't get that job, you know? Not because you're not qualified. Not it's just lightning has to strike. The things have to line up correctly. So, I mean, I think there's a vastly overlooked and underrated part of this entire career, which is just doing that kind of work.
But don't you think, I think I might be wrong even before I say this, but don't you think that there is a difference with directors, the directing role, and pretty much every other role, with the exception of maybe cast? Because at least on a TV show, don't you have like the creator wants to do two episodes, then the star wants to do an episode, and then this one. Is there a situation where a showrunner is going to say, oh, we're desperate for a director, unless it's maybe a pilot? Or
you mean desperate for a specific director or just can't find one?
Yeah. Is there a sit where someone's like calling Kabir and saying, hey, we need a good director for this. Do you need one? Is that a call that people make?
Yeah. I mean, most of the time those calls will go to the agencies, but before they go to the agencies, they're going to friends. They're going to showrunners are calling showrunner friends, studio execs friends who are making these suggestions. We just had John direct this show for us, says someone at ABC. And he was great.
It was a great time.
Yeah. Yeah. And the episode came out great, which is a critical, critical thing. The editor and me used to fight against a lot, which was like, well, this episode came out great. And well, it doesn't mean that sometimes it was despite these directors. And don't get me wrong, I cut footage for so many very good directors who clearly, cleanly understood having a point of view, camera movement, performance, being efficient on a day, treating a crew well. I mean, you just watch, just be around and watch and see what like things you don't like seem to work and what don't work. They weren't overshooting and they weren't beating the actors into submission, but they also weren't undercovering and leaving me as the editor pounding the desk being, there's only like two usable takes of this line and they're both obscured by this other person crossing this background crossing the camera at the time. So they're not usable.
Yeah. So, but I guess in all those examples of, oh, we just had Michelle shoot a couple episodes of Crazy Ex for us. She was amazing. You'll love her. But that's the story you hear about the directors that I guess are already established.
Right. Okay.
Is there, how do you get in if you're not established, I guess, as a director? Well, because even that Tracy Ullman example, I mean, I'm assuming the shooting in India thing gave you a point of view.
Yeah. I mean, being brown definitely seems to have helped, for sure. I mean, look, I'm from Philadelphia, so I'm not, like, I grew up here.
Right. But when you're pitching yourself, instead of saying, hey, this is how I would shoot it, and I would use this, and I thought it would be really cool if we used soundtrack from this time.
Oh my God.
You're just saying, oh, you're shooting in India? I know that world. Let me direct it, right?
I don't even think I went that far. I just sort of let this. You want people to make these connections in their head as best as they can, have more of an effective Inception-style conversations with people. I was thrilled that they gave me the shot, and it was great. It went great. I mean, I went out there and I directed those two episodes, and when I was there, they offered to give me more episodes, which was great. So I wound up staying for longer than I planned, which was an amazing experience. But I'll tell you, from the career game end of it, they came out really well. I was really proud of them. Yeah, I definitely walked in there being like, I know what I'm doing. And I watched them now, and I'm like, they're good. I could have done better. I just didn't. Those were my first three that I ever did. But I came back here after I was done. We finished editing them in London, came back here, was really excited. I was like, check this out. I've done these three episodes. And it's funny because meeting after meeting I had at studios, they all were like, we love this show. It's so funny. We can't recommend you for any of our shows because your show is not American.
Really? Hmm. Because people didn't know it or because the way it was shot was differently?
I truly...
So there's a frame rate difference. It's PAL versus NTSC.
We're shooting 25, not 24, you see. So it's a whole different...
Yeah.
I don't know, man. We were shooting with two cameras in English and doing jokes with actors. It's a pretty normal 22-minute situation. But I think that it just was something that people just didn't understand. Mm-hmm. I also think that was 2009 when there was not as much of a recognition that other points of view were important. Representation was not as big a deal. And not, I mean, not to put too fine a point on it, but I also think that the international TV that people were used to watching then were all white people. You know, and this is a show with like all brown people. And I think that was very, it just looked foreign. And it just seemed unusual and like exotic and strange. So I found also at the time that another piece of career advice I give people is that when I got to direct that show, it was really an exciting opportunity. But also it was like suddenly career success on the graph went really high up for those few months. It's like, oh my God, here, we've arrived directing an episodic show. This is amazing. Finally getting the chance.
International travel.
Yeah, you know, like this is dope. Like, you know, getting work it out and like really saving, you know. And I was able to obviously apply so much of what I knew for cutting because I was like, we don't have to shoot these things. Like, we can't use this shot. You get suggestions from people all the time, which are very helpful. But sometimes you're like, we can't use it. Let's move on. We'll save time in our day. We only have however many minutes in a day.
Yeah. What are some of the things that you see now in those episodes that you would have done differently now? Is there anything technical?
I think the biggest thing is I'm a lot better at staging scenes, actors, blocking, et cetera. Camera blocking around actors and just being a bit more dynamic and interesting and trying to keep stuff looking authentic, but also shooting it in a way that's efficient. I have a director friend who's very smart, and she will point out how sometimes you'll see less experienced people line up a scene with, say, three actors or whatever, or multiple actors, just all in a straight, and like one after the next, in a line, and she refers to this as birds on a wire, which is it's a very funny way to describe it. She's right. And, you know, it's just harder it's faster to shoot, for sure. You're lighting along one axis now, just like down the straight line. You can just be covering each person, turning around and talking to the next person. But humans don't stand that way. There's sort of a lack of verisimilitude there. And just, you can feel the inauthenticity when you're watching something like that. It feels, in a way, it just can feel inexplicably cheap to viewers. It doesn't feel like it's a real thing that real humans do.
Right.
I think that when I was shooting those first episodes, I would come in with, like, you know, really meticulously planned out diagrams about like how the scene was going to be blocked and what we were going to do and when actors would go from here to there. And which I mean, was great. And I still plan these things out, but the mistake I was making then was that I was imposing the plan on everybody else. As opposed to now I walk onto a set and I always have a plan, a really detailed plan, and usually a couple versions of a plan for how to shoot a scene, but I don't show it to anybody. I know what I'm looking for, but you only get people's best original ideas spontaneously once, especially in episodic TV where actors know their characters better than, you know, I do, showing up to do two or three episodes a year. You don't want to be dictatorial about it. The more democratic you are about it, I think you end up not only having a more successful day and people, you know, feeling like they're a part of it and valued, but also having a more successful end product that feels more organic.
But are you not having meetings with your crew ahead of time saying to the DP, we're going to be filming in this direction, saying to the AD, I want to do a few shots here in the kitchen area and then we're going to go to the hallway?
Yeah, for sure. For sure. But usually I'm trying to make sure we're prepared for all these things. For eventuality A, B, C, D, and E. Let's just be prepared for these things. We may not use them. Which ones of these can we be prepared for that do not cost a lot of money or time? And if we're going to spend the money and the time, then let's make sure we're actually going to do it. I mean, it's all kind of a balancing act with those sorts of things. But so rather than me just impose a vision and also restrict everybody else from having the opportunity to conceptualize something on their own and then bring it to the table, which is, I mean, they're professionals at it. They're professionals at their own physicality and moving around and understanding like how they can best tell the story that's true to their own character. So they'll know it better than I will. Right. So I find it's much better if they can contribute to that, because then you get great ideas from people.
And what I love about that mentality, though, is that that shows that you're collaborative, right? Like, that proves to them that you want to work with them and their ideas are valuable and important. But then also that the act of reshaping things a tiny bit just lets them know that you had a plan. You're just listening to them. You were saying before about when you're younger, it feels like, oh, I need to have the answer, right? The flip side of that is you don't want to feel like just letting them go willy-nilly, then they won't trust you. I used to say things like, well, let's just see how it falls off the truck, right? And I knew that I knew what I wanted, but I wanted to see how it was going to land. But every once in a while, you would see that twinge of does he know what he wants, or am I doing his job for him?
Yes. You know? It's important to balance that, for sure. You're turning the dials all day long on how much you're saying about laying down the law versus just being wide open to other people's ideas.
Right.
Or how much you're asking other people what they want to do and how much you have to be no, we have to keep moving.
I think that's just something that comes with experience, but also I think if it's informed by the knowledge of what you need editing wise or what's going to make your day a little faster and a little smoother, those little tweaks people notice. That's the sign that you really know what you're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. I can think of a lot of specific examples of where this has come into play. I had an episode of a show that I walked onto set, and I'd met the cast before, but it's like Monday morning, 7, and for schedule reasons, it only worked out that we had to start with first scene up Monday morning was a 7-person scene, which is unfortunate.
Rock and roll.
You gotta roll your sleeves up and go for it.
Yeah.
I tried to find a way to consolidate it so we could shoot it quickly but still have it interesting. I was like, once you've kind of come in at this point, why don't you have a seat right here? Because a lot of times the actors would be like, okay, where do you want me at this table, you know? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, here, why don't you get here and here, and you'll just come, when you come in, end up over here. And, you know, she was like, well, but I feel like I would end up at the head of this table for this reason. And I was like, okay. Now, in my head, I knew that if we did that, because I had spent a lot of time on this ahead of time, if we did that, it would change the geometry, the camera blocking, the whole scene in such a way that it was going to add a lot of shots, because now we needed reactions of certain people looking in multiple different directions. And I was like, I mean, I swear, this is like 7:02 in the morning on Monday. And I'm like, fuck. So I was like, okay, great, let's try it. You know, maybe, I mean, look, maybe I'm wrong. You know, sometimes you get in the space, and while we're doing a rehearsal, I'm working with the actors, I'm also walking around it over and over just to keep looking at it from different sides. And I was like, I could see that it was not going to work. It was going to just be much harder. And again, editor me knows that a lot of times you get scenes where they've shot way too many setups, and you're like, oh my God, why do they shoot so much? You don't need all this. Yeah. So we did a rehearsal, and we're going to run it again. And I was like, hey, if you move over here, if you're comfortable moving over to here, we'll get out of the scene an hour earlier. And she was like, okay. And I was like, oh my God.
Yeah, no, I think that's awesome. Like, I try to share the technical stuff with the cast as much as I can, too.
Yeah.
There's some people that don't care. They're like, yeah, whatever, wherever you want to put the light, wherever the mark is, I don't care. And other people are like, what? You see down to here, my belly button, or down to my waist? And
I think that's also, if you're on season 3 of a show, all these ensemble TV actors are much more in tune with the timing and all the things that it takes. Whereas, again, a commercial, saving an hour for them isn't as exciting. Do you know what I mean? Like, that hour means they get to go see their kids a lot sooner.
Yes.
Whereas on a single day shoot or 2-day shoot, it's not quite the same.
Things are certainly different in season 1 of a show where it's still new to everybody. And look, we were talking earlier about the roadblocks and the connecting of the dots to get from point A to point B career-wise. You know, and I had started out cutting nonfiction cable, and to have gotten to a point now where I'm directing premium scripted Netflix type shit is like very, very exciting. But each one of those was a step. When I came back from directing Mumbai Calling, I realized that I had gone up so quickly that there was sort of no superstructure around me to keep me up at that level. Like, I didn't know all the studio execs that I needed to know. I didn't have those relationships. My agent situation wasn't that good, and like, I didn't have all the experience, the credits. There's a lot of these things that you kind of have to build it one piece at a time, and it's frustrating because it feels a lot like, well, I should just get there.
I did a bunch of episodes of a TV show.
Yeah.
It was a big deal.
I did 3 episodes of this primetime series.
So let's talk was it literally through editing that you built that superstructure that you're referring to?
Absolutely. A couple more years, and I wound up in rapid succession. I was cutting part of the opening film for the Emmys 2011, which was, again, with people who I loved working with. And there was a reason that they needed to shoot one extra scene or whatever for this opening film. And the guy I was working for was really, really excellent dude to me for years. He had directed it, and he was not available the night they needed to shoot it. So he was just like, you should just go do it.
Sure.
Yeah. And I was like, oh man, I remember being like, dude, that is great. Thank you so much. Like, I'm really grateful for the opportunity, even though I know it was an easy call because I'm right here. And he's like, it's not an easy call at all. He's like, you probably would not get approved by the network to do it. We're just going to do it. And I was like, okay.
And was it a celebrity that you shot?
Yeah. Yeah. It was great. It was a really fun shoot with Jane Lynch and with Leonard Nimoy. Yeah.
Oh, cool.
And then a few months later, I got the call to edit the opening film for the Oscars that Billy Crystal was in, where Billy's in all the different movies. And like, it's a classic. Sure, we all, movie lovers, we've all seen that. And I was like, oh my God, working at the Academy Awards and like Billy Crystal? That's incredible. It was one of those things where I was like, I got a chance to
never going back to the Emmys.
No, exactly. I was like, I'll be so jealous if anyone else got to do it. Please have me do it. Have me do it. And that was great too, because doing that, I ended up, you know, working with Billy, and then like, they had a thing that came up at the end of the day before the Oscars. They wrote like a 1-minute scene with Billy Crystal and Melissa McCarthy, like a backstage at the Oscars scene that we shot the night before, and they asked me to direct it. So I got to do that.
I feel like this advice, you're just kind of throwing it out there, but it's pretty amazing. You know, I think when new filmmakers move to LA and they're trying to make it in Hollywood, one of the things that you hear a lot your first couple of years in Hollywood is stop telling people that you're an aspiring director, that you want to be an actor, that you're kind of dabbling in writing. Tell people you're a writer. Tell people you're a director. Tell people, doesn't matter if you have no credits or if you're just working on your first script now.
You need to own it. And I think what you're saying is kind of the extreme version of that, which is make the connection so that you're in the room. And when someone asks you to recommend a director, you say, hey, I know the perfect person. And it's me.
And it's me. Especially, I think, having already talked to those people. Listen, again, if you look at it as a continuum, there's a point at which you have like a large body of work and no one questions that you can direct this right. movie or direct this episode or whatever, right? And over here on the opposite side, there's a point where you have no body of work, right? So as you're slowly sliding along and you pick up one and then you pick up two and now you've picked up four and it's sort of just expanding, you get to a point where at the beginning you're trying to convince the people that you, who trust you to let you direct something small. At least this is the way I was going. I mean, look, there's people who have famous parents who got to direct a giant studio feature when they were 28, and that's cool for them. But yeah. Absent that, it's sort of a gradual acceleration of showing that you have work that you've done that people have seen or have heard of or can watch, right? While also earning the trust of people by spending time with them in a creative space. And it's difficult because you work with PAs who are talented, who are nice people. You obviously want to be respectful of people all the way up and down the crew list. And you can see that they want to be filmmakers, which is very exciting because it was all of us, you know? But it's hard to be like, it's hard for a studio executive, and it's hard for the network, and it's hard for the exec producer sometimes to say, okay, person who's the PA, we like you, we get you, you understand, but we haven't seen you do anything like this on our show. We can't put you in charge of this $3 million episode.
Right, right.
Which you understand.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. Just to kind of circle back to Oren, your point about Kabir, you're just proving the fact that, like, oh, being in the building and being the guy who's like, hey, I'm a director, sign me up, put me in, coach, right?
Absolutely.
I think there's two important things. One, you were editing most of the time, right? In which case, your contributions to the creative were huge, invaluable. Right. You understood what was happening in the show. You're aware of network notes, you probably know plenty of the executives,
right.
How the machine works. So it's not the same as a person who was day playing on a set. It's like, wouldn't it be good if this happened? You know,
right.
Like you have an informed opinion.
That's a very smart observation. I think that was a vital component that I had been missing,
right.
Doing one by calling and not understanding quite the level of details. I was good at figuring out how a day could go, but I took some time off from that. I said to focus on just expanding that knowledge and having my reps at the time, my manager was setting up a lot of great meetings with these executives. And again, when I was younger, my first agent would send me out to these meetings with, you know, execs at the studio, and you go sit down and talk with them, these general meetings, right? So you go and just, it's friend dating, basically, right?
Right.
I would go to these meetings and they would go well and they'd be like, love watching your show. Here's the shows we have coming up. We'll keep an eye out for whatever is coming up before. We'll talk with your reps. And I was like, great. Awesome to meet you. And then I would leave and call my agent.
You're good in the room.
Thanks.
That's a thing that's important as well, right? You're personable. You're likable. You can talk, right?
Like,
not every filmmaker is that, right?
No, for sure. It's important to be able to connect. And you want to have enough confidence that you're showing people, you can put me in charge of your multi-million-dollar project
and
it'll be okay. Because I have a track record, or at the time I didn't really, but you're just still, there's definitely, you got to like, talk up a bit of it.
To know the jargon and talk the talk and understand.
Yeah. Right. Well, that was the thing.
Show them I had the same language.
A mistake that I used to make in these meetings is I used to go into the meetings and try very hard to make sure that everybody understood that I know how to direct, which not
you're
only...
Like, oh, yeah, when they clap the slate, which, by the way, we sync with the sound, the audio. <playing template. laughs>
You say that, but I was definitely saying stupid shit close to that granular that I didn't need to be saying.
Some circular track, don't worry.
Yeah, exactly. There's an 18-footer. I don't really like the 15-footers. No one is hiring you to direct a show based on that. They're looking for confidence, personality, competence, experience, and just storytelling understanding, which just oftentimes you can track in people just from having conversations with them,
right?
So I would go to these meetings, and I would come out of these things, I'd call my agent, and I'd be like, I met with so-and-so at the studio, and it went great, and my agent would say, great, we'll follow up. And I'd be like, awesome, I'm in the system now, my reps are going to connect with the execs, and they're going to find a project for me, which is absolutely not how it works, right? The critical underpinning, the mistake I was making was not developing a relationship with those executives myself.
And so what would you have done differently? Going back in time, how do you develop that relationship with those execs yourself?
I think it's a matter of staying in touch with these people yourself. Your agents can follow up, and they're aware of where there are shows that are looking for open slots for directors, or where there are pilots that are looking for, which companies you've met with. But I do a lot of this keeping track of stuff work myself. I have an Excel spreadsheet because I have spreadsheets, and I can't recommend them enough. I have an Excel spreadsheet that tracks all the executives I've met, where I met them, when I met them, when I last saw them, what they're on now. I just update it myself.
No, I don't think you're the first
TV director that's told us this.
I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, I think it's vital to be aware. There's the part of the job that is being on set and directing, and then there's the other part of the job that is just keeping your career going. Hmm. I met up with a big name director years ago. I saw him speak at something and went up to him afterwards. I just happened to, you know a bunch of the stuff he'd worked on, and he was like, hey, that's interesting. If you ever want to get breakfast and talk more. And I was like, oh my God, that's awesome. I'd love to do that. I remember he's like, hey, his office set up like a 7 a.m. breakfast in the Palisades. And I was like,
which like, is pretty David far Fincher, away from Silver Wake, I'll everyone.
And he was a half hour late, which is what it is. I just sat there in this little breakfast place, wondering, like, am I in the wrong place? I didn't know. I didn't have a way to get in touch with him, right?
Yeah. And then what did you, did, because I've actually had like a similar type of experience where I met this director and I said, let's have dinner or whatever. And then once we were sitting down at dinner, he goes, so what do you want? What do you want to talk about?
Yes.
And I was like, I don't know.
Right. Because, I just wanted to know, like, if I could do what you do. Like, do your friends want to hire me to do your job? Like, you know, like he's, since then he's been off like directing Game of Thrones. So I don't think he's, I'm sure he's doing fine. But he said it to me too. He was like, I told him a lot about what I was doing. And he, you know, was like, you're doing all the right things. So just keep going. And I was like, man, I'm spending so much time like connecting with executives and producers and doing a lot of this. And he's like, I do that too. And I was like, oh my God, if you are still doing that at you're the top of the game, I have nothing to bitch about. It's like bitching about traffic in LA. It just is what it is. You accept it as being part of the game is the game, right?
Yeah.
So I mean, I'll tell you that like there's a rapid domino effect that happened following the Oscars, which is that I directed this thing and I edited the opening film. And a few months later, I was in the mix to possibly be hired on Arrested Development to edit the show. And at the time, I had been, you gotta understand, like I had known people who had been PAs and producers, you know, who had moved up to the producer level by then on network series. And I started getting calls about shows at, I don't know, NBC, ABC, all this, MTV, right? To come and cut some episodes of our show. And I was like, oh my God, that's great. I've been cutting for 14 years at the time and still like doing some stuff that I hated, some garbage program just to get a paycheck and trying and failing to kind of break into something bigger and getting told at every turn, you just haven't done one yet. And I'm like, I know that. That's why I'm here talking to you. And again, I understand. As coming in as a stranger, are you going to hire a stranger who has the wrong experience on the resume? No. Would you hire a friend with the wrong experience? Maybe. Would you hire a stranger with the right experience? Probably.
Right,
but
right.
I got to the point where I had meetings with some of these people. A friend on an NBC show had come in, meet with our post team, and I did. And it went great. And they're like, well, we're going to be starting. You'll start next week or whatever. Here's a rate. Here's a start date. We just need a copy of your resume to send to the studio so they can sign off. And then hours later, I got a call saying, actually, you know what? We're so sorry. The studio says we can't hire you. I'm like, what do you mean? Why? They're like, they just don't think you have the right credits. I'm like, yeah, but who? I'll talk to them. They're like, it's too late. I was like, okay.
Yeah.
This happened on a couple different shows. And in shortly after the Oscars, in May of 2012, this happened on an MTV series. And I was like, oh my God, I used to cut all these MTV reality shows, and now MTV is telling me that I can't work there. And then 8 weeks later, after lightning struck, because my friend was, the guy I'd been working for a long time, became an EP, exec producer on Arrested Development, and I'd become his go-to editor for a lot of things. And 20th Century Fox had offered the editing job to everybody who had worked on it in the past, and they all said no. And to probably everybody else who they knew in their regular rotation, and they all said no. I know because I've spoken to all these people. I'm friends with them all now, but I didn't know any of these people back then.
Right.
Then there was
a show to work on.
There was a magic day. There was a magic day. It was a Thursday when Emmy noms came out. I didn't know better at the time. The Oscars broadcast that year got nominated for an Emmy for best editing of that kind of show. And my name,
oh, nice.
And my name was not on it.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
And what they had done is they had listed a bunch of other people, and they had capped the number of people eligible to be listed at 7.
Yeah, they capped the list, and also, again, it's probably just like whomever is filling out the form.
Yes, and I was long...
So much for your last name starting with A, huh?
Yes, exactly. That was one of those they were going backwards times. The teacher used to go backwards. We're going to start with the Z kids today. Zimmerman, you're up.
And they're also really sticklers about changing it. You can't, once it's submitted, that's that.
That
right?
is so absolutely
like,
that.
So, like, the associate producer's name is on that list, even though you're one of the editors, right?
Absolutely.
That's just me just guessing. Maybe that's literally true, but...
It's that sort of thing that happened. And I was very... I mean, I was, 31, and I had been doing this for a while. I was like, oh, my God, what? It is the Emmys and the Oscars. These are things you see on TV, right? And as a kid, you're like, that'd be cool. You practice your acceptance speech in the shower, but it's not real. It's not really going to happen. But then that happened. I was like, oh, my God, this is happening. This could have happened to me just now. And it didn't. And I was very concerned that they were going to win. Luckily, it did not win. But I also learned a lesson. So that 6 years later, when I was editing the Oscars again, by then I had learned enough that I joined the Television Academy, which seemed weird. I was like, I was at some networking event and a mysterious older man said to me, I was just at, we're sharing a high top table. I was just drinking and just talking to this guy. I didn't know who he was. And he was like, I told him what I was up to and what I've been working on. And he was like, are you in the TV Academy? I was like, no, I don't know how that works. And he goes, well, it sounds like you have enough credits. You just have to apply and get some signatures. He's like, I'm a member. I'll sign you in. And I was like, really? Oh my God. Okay. So he did. And I joined. And I mean, you can look it up now on Emmys.com. It's super easy, right? You just go and look up your member. You need this many credits and a couple signatures and you pay the fee or whatever. So I did. And that way, when I had edited this part for the Oscars, I was sure to submit it myself. And I started going to these just networking events. And I met a lot of people, including I met a bunch of former editors on Arrested Development whose names that I knew from watching shows, right? So join late 2011. I do the Oscars in early 2012. I get nagged by MTV in May of 2012. I submit in May of 2012 to the Oscars. In June of 2012, I go to these networking events. I meet these people. In July, I get nominated for an Emmy for cutting the Oscars. And on that same day, the nomination was enough to convince whoever it was at 20th to sign off on hiring me for Arrested Development. In August, I start on Arrested Development, and the TV Academy does an annual panel with a bunch of nominated editors. And they called, because I had met a bunch of these people at this event, they called to ask me to be on the panel. And one of the guys who was at the Academy called me to pre-interview me for the panel or whatever. Mm-hmm. He used to cut on Arrested Development and gave me all this great advice about how to handle things that I should watch out for, things that would be work and all this, and it was really helpful. And in August, that Arrested Development ended up cutting in the same hallway as that MTV show that told me I was not qualified. And the one of the producers on that show, who was not involved in the me being hired or not hired debacle, we all just sit outside and have lunch together every day, and he was like tearing his hair out, and I was like, what's up? And he's like, all of our editors are leaving. They're all going back to their fall shows, and our schedule's running over, and you know, I was like, oh man, I wish I could help you out. He's like, oh my God, are you kidding? Emmy-nominated editor of Arrested Development, they'd love to have you. And I was like, you guys hear that? They'd love to have me. When 8 weeks prior, that show wouldn't touch me.
Sure.
Yeah. So what changed? The headline changed with a lot of proper nouns. Emmy-nominated Arrested Development. And like, following that, then a couple years, I cut it Arrested, which led to a second Emmy nom. And then it went straight from that because 20th wanted to keep me around, so I went to cut it New Girl for a couple years. And then going back to your point you were making earlier about jumping ship, is that I was working at New Girl, and it was a hit show, and you're not supposed to do this career-wise, but I wasn't happy there. It just, I asked them about directing, and they kept saying, we'll see.
Sure. You're in the editing bucket.
Yeah, right? Very much.
Yeah.
And at some point, I was like, I just don't think this is the right fit. I love a lot of people that were also very good friends, but it just wasn't the right fit. So my editing agent had sent me a script for a musical pilot, and I was like, I love this show. Also, I was a musical theater kid, and so they hired me, and I left New Girl mid-season, which was a scary thing to do, but I just felt like it was the right thing to do.
And this was Crazy Ex-Girlfriend.
Right, and then I was right, by the way. We did the pilot for Showtime. Showtime did not pick it up. And then 6 months later, CW did pick it up. So we recut the pilot a little bit. I mean, we'd made this raunchy, R-rated Showtime half hour, and then we basically turned that into a Monday night at 8 p.m. CW 1 hour. But while retaining the same DNA and not changing a ton, I just recut as much as I could to make it longer, and we shot a couple of new scenes. And to think that I made that decision just because I felt I would be happier with these people, and then what it ended up leading to was obviously that pilot got nominated then for an Emmy, and then I won somehow, incredibly, at the Emmys for cutting that pilot, which another network had thrown out, which involved quitting it, working on a hit show to go just to be happier, and then working at Crazy X, you know, they knew that I wanted to direct, and the show got a second season.
Right.
They
and you're part of the DNA of that show at that point.
Right.
I mean, like you have like more leverage to be like, hey, you guys, you have to let me direct some episodes.
Yeah, and the best thing is, I mean, they were such great people about it. They knew that I wanted to be directing. They had said, like, if we get a second season for sure, because like studios first season shows, there's a lot at stake. You know, they're looking to get a second show season and so on. We get picked up for season two. And man, that was it. I got offered that one, and I was jumping up and down. It took there's the three Mumbai Calling episodes, but to get one of these that everyone had been telling me for years, you just got to get that one. Meeting after meeting for 10 years, people will be like, you just got to get that one. We can't give it to you, but you just go get one somewhere else.
Sure, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and call us when you got one.
And I'll tell you what happened is I did that one, and it went great, and immediately I started having top-level meetings at places, and every one of these offices that I've been banging on their doors trying to get in to just to have a meeting for years, suddenly they're all like, I can't believe we haven't met.
Yeah, you're like, tell me about it.
And I'm like, yeah, I know. I've been trying very hard.
All right, so, Kabir, I think, just to reiterate, the big takeaway I'm hearing out of all of this is, like, it's not just be in the room, but it's, like, there is a sincere amount of continuing to hustle and network, right? Like you're saying, like, oh, you're going to all of these, you know, TV Academy mixers and things like that. Those are not fun. You know what I mean? They're not, it's like,
oh,
it's
I love like, it. I okay, love it.
Well, you're a social butterfly then.
But I love people. I'm like an extrovert. So.
No, Matt, you go to those things all the time, those types of things.
My point is that it would be easy to be like, I'm an Emmy nominated editor. I'm a member of the, you know, TV Academy now. Like, I don't need to go drink well Jack and Cokes at this mixer and like bump into the same 20 weirdos that I always talk to.
That is an excellent description of it. However, freshman year college me knows that free stuff is still good.
It's not free though. I know how much those membership dues are.
Like 100 something a year. Like, yeah, you know.
I think it's 186.
Yeah. But like as an investment, right? I mean, ultimately you gotta spend money to make money, right? Like
that is true. That is true.
I know I'm being facetious, but serious in a way too, that there's so much you can do mm-hmm. in order to get the opportunity to do the things you want to do. Right? Like I say this a lot too, but like it's the best way I've thought of this is that it's like your career. It's like having a garden, and I don't know anything about gardening, but like every person you meet is like planting a seed. Mm-hmm. It's like a seed you get. And the mistake I used to make, like I was saying before with those agency setup meetings, is like I would go to these meetings with executives and I'd be like, great, I got this seed. I'm going to plant it in the ground. And that's great. I did it. Like, it's going to lead to a job. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't watering it. And now, then you also got to remember that a large percentage of the seeds you water aren't going to come up and flower or lead to a job, you know? Right. And some mm-hmm. of them
they're going to go into house flipping.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. Some are going to move home to like Nebraska. Yeah. And a lot of them are not going to come up ever. And some of them might not come up for 10 years. Mm-hmm. When I got hired on Arrested Development, I mean, the guy who was instrumental in that, who was a, you know, my friend and mentor, I had met him 10 years before that. Mm-hmm. Right. And, you know, when I, at Crazy X, when we got a second season and, you know, it's just so much of this is about being in the room, you know, like I had just, they knew that I wanted to be directing, but also like, yeah, you're right. I had become part of the, I had helped like create the vibe of the show, you know, as a filmmaker. They offered me that one. And suddenly, you know, the way that these meetings would get set up changed beforehand. It had been like, you know, my agent could set up a meeting with like a, you know, low level executive 6 weeks from now that would get rescheduled. And as soon as that one aired, it was like much higher level meetings in a week everywhere. And like I said, they all, you know, everyone's like, well, I can't believe we haven't met. And then the next, we got a third season. And then, you know, I asked about doing two episodes and they let me do two. And then coming off of that, because, you know, I heard for years, you hear for years, the first thing you hear is you just got to get that one. You got to go get your first one. We can't give it to you. And then after that, the thing you hear from everybody is you got to show that you can get asked back on that show. Because that shows that now you've... you know,
that really, they were happy with you.
Yes, mm-hmm. Now you've actually done the work and it's been good. It's a clear, explicit endorsement. And then I did that. And then what you hear from everybody, I swear, is you just got to show that you can get a second series now. And I remember I said to my reps at the time, I was like, are you serious? Are we going to keep moving the bar like this?
Yeah, yeah.
And the response was, no, after you get a second series, then we're off to the races. And I was like, come
on. Oh, that's good.
And I was like, I can't. I was like, sure.
It's true for you, right?
I have found that it's true for a lot of people. It was absolutely true for me. I did got that coming off of having multiple episodes of Crazy X. All the executives, I mean, you know, I'd become friends with these people. I'll just go and hang out with them and even get a beer. But like the feedback I started getting was like, are you even going to be available?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Seems like the paradigm shift is your first meetings with executives were your agent calling them up and saying, hey, we've got a client you'll really love. You've got to meet him. He's amazing. Beer. He's a rock star. And they go, you meet them and they're like, okay, great. Yeah, we'll keep him in mind. Now these new meetings are, now you're on these lists of potential directors.
the list, right?
Right.
You always hear about the mystical list, but like studios have a list of pre-approved directors that you can only hire from.
Right. Or even if it's just that, like, oh, I just talked to my friend who has this show and he said they worked with this director and he was great. I think that puts you into the ether in a different way of, like, instead of giving someone an opportunity, it's having an opportunity to work with someone that already does this.
When it's safe, and it's safe enough that you can trust them, you know, it's, you know, started moving really quickly, you know. You think about goals you have and looking to get to the point where you're full-time directing like this, and it's going well and successful. And my girlfriend and I had a, you know, conversation, I remember in the kitchen right as Crazy Ex was ending. And we were trying to figure out, like, she's like, how many episodes would you need to get next season in order to be able to, like, just, you know, you've stopped editing already now. It's been hard to stop. And, you know, I edited the last Crazy Ex. It was my show and I loved it and I wanted to do the last one. But I hadn't done any that whole last season anyway. It had already been, you know, a whole year of not cutting. And she was like, how many episodes do you think you'd need to get? And I was like, well, you know, they pay really well. I think that we could get by if I got two in the next season. Two would be really great. And I remember I was like, three would be like unbelievable. It would mean that it was working. Like all the work we had done, like all the years and years, my rep setting up meetings and me doing this, trying to learn and get better and making mistakes and running dead ends and all this. Three would mean it worked. I remember she was like, but what about one? She's like, one would be a bad sign. Cause why did you only get one after all this? And I was like, right. And then I ended up doing 12. And I ended up I was actually offered 16. I just couldn't do them all because I was too busy.
Yeah. Right. Well,
so now drink strong Kabir, right?
Two people that you can recommend when you're in your car.
Right. Exactly. I mean, it was really incredible to watch the calendar just fill up last year to be like, oh my God, this was the goal and the plan and the dream. Then it happened. Right. And then, you know, definitely had a few minutes now through last season. I'm so busy. And then, like, as it ended, to be like, okay, cool. Now what?
Yeah. So that genuinely, now what? Right. Like, I think that it's interesting to be like, oh, I've always dreamt of directing TV full time and you're doing it. But that same sort of drive that kept you going to those mixers and going to meetings and all of that stuff, like, that's going to keep you, there's still gas in the tank, right? You're going to continue to keep going.
Yeah.
So what's on the horizon for you? What are you dreaming of next?
Well, that's what's so interesting now, to be like, the goal for so long, you know, was at the beginning, it's kind of amorphous, right? It's directing, you know, what does that mean? You know, and at some point it became like focused directing on, like, you know, primetime, premium, big name, brand name, episodic content. Mm-hmm. Great. Okay.
Great. And then it narrows down. Now it's like, oh, it's like comedy and musical comedy are kind of your two sweet spots, right?
They have been, you know, and like I've been starting to get these 1 hours. I did a couple 1 hours last year, which was also fun and different.
Which ones did you do?
I did 90210 last year, which was a really interesting experience because
the 90210 with the original cast.
Yeah, which is the type of show I hadn't really worked on before, but I loved doing
it. Which is a comedy. The new one was kind of more of a comedy than the original, right?
Right, especially my one was. I think, you know, they had hired a lot of, they were bifurcated in a way with some drama, some comedy stuff. And I, you know, did a couple episodes of a half hour for Netflix that was, we were talking about this, it was a half hour musical drama. Like it was like, you know, some jokes, but it was very, you know, powerful. And I thought we were able to shoot it really beautifully. It is not out yet. It'll be out on Netflix in a few months, called Julie and the Phantoms. It's like a musical, high school based
fun
half hour. Cool. It was really, yeah. And I was like, how can we shoot it like a comic book sometimes? So I was like, let's just start getting away with like trying different shit. You know, like in that first episode you do, you're like, just want to make sure it all comes out cool. You know, want to make sure like it all cuts together. Let's like try to, let's do like a cool thing or two, but let's not go crazy, right?
Sure.
Let's just make sure we turn in something that is like, that works. You know, so we have the opportunity to go do another.
And by the last episode, you're just shooting it all on iPhones.
Yeah, basically. We're just like doing like crazy lens shit and like, you know, what can we get away with, you know? But I mean, I'll say, you know, you asked a question a while ago that I wanted to speak to, which was like, how do you get out of the box? Like, how do you stop cutting? Because like,
sure, yeah,
people start looking and being like, well, we can't lose you from post.
Yeah, like if you become, you know, a linchpin, right? If you're the keystone of an editorial department or whatever department you're in, even if you're just like a kick-ass PA, it's really hard to find people who kick ass at their jobs. So like, it's almost easier to go find somebody else, and it doesn't require them to reconfigure their conception of what you do. Do you know what I mean?
Completely. But also it makes it easier for whoever's in charge to leave you where you are.
Right.
If you're good at it, right. Which is completely understandable. I mean, why change two things when you could just change one thing?
Sure. Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Like it's just one more headache. And, you know, running a show is such a stressful, full-time, nonstop thing going on. Like there's so much that you're in charge of. And obviously personally for you when you're doing it, it's very high stakes. There's a lot of money involved, a reputation involved, responsibility, you know, to the studio. And there's a lot of those parts going on. So the less you can disrupt, the better.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't know, just having done some research on like management techniques and so on, you see a lot of examples, people talking about it, how important it is to be training your replacement.
Oh, interesting.
Crazy X was very good fortune for me in many ways. And one of the myriad serendipitous things that happened is that we ended up filming the show on something that could only generously be called a studio lot. It was more like a parking lot with a, you know, warehouses that we use as sound stages. But also production was there, the stages were there, post was there, and the writers were there all in one place. And there was nobody else there.
Mm-hmm.
So from my editing office, the stage, the set was 20, 30 steps away.
Nice. Yeah, that's great.
So I got to know the crew and I got to know the cast. And when the time came for me to leave, you know, there was concern about like, well, what's going to happen? Who's going to be dealing with covering your spot back here?
Mm-hmm.
But I had an assistant who was great. And I just spent a lot of time training her to take over for me. So, and everybody knew her. They all knew her because they all spent FaceTime with her. And I'd also, you know, over the run of the first season, been encouraging people to spend time with her, you know, partly because I wanted to help her and partly because I was like, this will help when I'm gone, then someone else can be here to fill in for me, you know? And then step by step, by the time I had moved out fully from cutting, she'd taken my spot as a full-time editor. And now she's like, you know, she just cut a feature for Universal. We're never going to get her back.
That's cool. Well, awesome. We should probably wrap up pretty soon. I guess the thing is, I think originally when we heard about you, it was in relation to Never Have I Ever, but I feel like that show needs very little promotion or plugging because I just keep seeing people posting on social media how sad they are that they have run out of show to watch.
Yeah, stunning, right? Especially, like I said, the timing of quarantine is one thing, but people love it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you can give really quarantine some credit for it a little bit, but I think it's a good show. You know, it's kind of like a four-quarter show. Right,
or four quadrant
show in a way, because you know, I'm an adult male watching this and I can relate so much to the main character who's how old is she? 15?
18.
Yes.
But in the show she plays, I think, a sophomore, she's 16.
Yeah, 16-year-old girl, Indian girl. And I don't know, it's just, and there's just this balance of edginess to authentic childhood moments to kind of broad comedy jokes and all done in a very cinematic way that is just moving and fast paced and just everyone has someone to look at that they can relate to on screen. If you don't want your kids to hear the word shit or fuck, maybe you don't want young kids watching this show,
you don't want to have to explain certain things to kids, but right, for the most part,
The primary storyline is about like losing her virginity, you know,
in
10th grade. So,
Pat, once that conversation has been taken care of,
it
appeals to everyone from thereafter.
It was incredibly fun to work on. It's probably my most favorite, like, just working experience. And maybe some of that is shaded by the fact that it was about a story that was very personal to me, also, just growing up as a first gen, you know.
Like, have you lost your virginity yet or no?
Working on it.
Okay, cool.
Yeah,
cool.
Yeah. All right. Any minute now.
All right.
He's met all the right people. He's had all the right meetings. Just next time someone says, who should I say, you know, a great guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You're just trying to get on. Yeah. Again, you get those on whims, right? It's like we were talking about before. Sure. Yeah. It's just very personal to me too, just to be able to tell the story of like a first generation, like brown kid, you know, and like, family who doesn't quite understand the culture and so on, but we're supportive and loving.
Mm-hmm.
And just to get to do that was like, you know, it was a lot of fun. And also, if you look at the way we shot those, it was a lot of fun too. I mean, the DP, Rhett, was extraordinarily good. Very good, very fast, and really chill dude also.
Mm-hmm.
Are you on social media if people want to follow you, see what you're up to?
Yeah, anything? Twitter, Instagram, you know, Kabir Akhtar, spelled just like my name is, which is hard for people to spell. Should really find something simpler now that you mention it. K-A-B-I-R-A-K-H-T-A-R.
Kabir, are you cool to hang out and endorse with us real quick?
Sure.
Unpaid endorsements.
Oren, you got anything?
So we interviewed a VFX guy, Lawson Deming, the other day, who owns the company Barnstorm VFX that works on a lot of awesome TV shows. And he had recommended if you are trying to get into 3D, you should learn Blender. And mm-hmm. So I downloaded Blender, even though I'm like, I use this other package called Cinema 4D, but I wanted to see what it's like. Blender is totally free. And there's this guy on YouTube. His name is Blender Guru. And he...
See, that's easy to spell.
Yeah. That's it. It's a weird name for his parents to name him. But it's... he does this tutorial where you just make this donut with sprinkles on it from scratch. And it's really awesome. And it's really easy. And you can learn how to... I don't know. I just really like him. So if you are interested in 3D and you don't want to spend any money, download Blender. It's free. And then check out this guy, Blender Guru, and he will teach you everything you ever wanted to know. Do you guys want to see my donut?
Yeah, show us your donut. What I love about the idea of doing a donut...
Oh, my God. That looks great.
It looks great, but also it's like there's a handful of core 3D modeling principles all wrapped into one object, right? You have to deal with different textures. The icing is different than the actual donut. Then you've got sprinkles on top,
and these sprinkles are like a particle system. And then I'm actually just halfway through the course. We're going to add a coffee mug and put some coffee in there in a cup and like build a little environment. But
I will say
your
donut
looks kind of photorealistic. Donut,
it looks a little light to me. I think you maybe should keep it. You fry it a touch longer next time.
Oh, that's, yeah, joking, but that's like literally the next lesson that I'm going to watch tonight is like how to get more brown fried looking.
It does look like a little bit like a bagel.
Mm-hmm.
But that is what Blender Guru also said. He's like, this kind of looks like a bagel right now, but we'll make it look like a donut. But anyway, highly recommended if you are interested at all in learning 3D.
Wonderful.
That's cool.
Mine is not super. I feel like we just did an episode with Clark Duke where Oren and I both had maybe some of our best, like smartest sounding endorsements we've ever done, you know? And he was like, oh, fuck. And this time around, it's like, well.
Yeah, the dumbest ones, yeah.
My endorsement is Calabrian chilies. Do you guys know Calabrian chilies?
No.
It's like the trendiest condiment right now. It's just like, they're just like a treated... like chilies, like a little red chili that they dice up and like, you know, you put in oil kind of like you would like sun-dried tomatoes or something like that. But they're a little sweet and a little spicy and you can basically put them on anything and it makes it taste fancy.
Okay, cool. So when you texted me the other day and asked me if I wanted to do it to have a collab with you, this is what you were referring to.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay.
Yeah.
I guess I won't send you that script after all.
But yeah. Calabrian chilies, they go great on sandwiches. I threw some on some pizza last night. They were incredible. You can throw them in mac and cheese.
Are you grinding tacos. Them up into like a powder or are you just doing them like
No. So they're wet, right? So they're in
like
oil.
Like jalapenos kind of?
Yeah, they're like jalapenos or something like that. But again, sweet. So you don't get the tang that you would with a jalapeno or a pickled onion. It's like more of like, but they pack a decent amount of heat too. So you a little dabble do ya, which is nice because it'll last for a long time. But it's a good way to spruce up whatever you're eating if you want to add a little extra funk and heat to some food. It's good.
A little dabble do ya.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Very Fred Flintstone.
I can't prepare to the book to talk about, but maybe.
Oh, that's perfect. No, that's actually sure? that's better than an apple core and some chilies.
I could talk about like, last time we went to the store, I was like, oh man, I haven't had bread and butter pickles in so long.
Yeah.
And like really, really enjoyed reconnecting with that part of my childhood, especially because like, you know, I was like, it's getting hot out now here. And
sure,
like,
yeah.
I finished all the pickles, but there was still so much pickle juice that I was like, what'll happen if I just drink the pickle juice from the jar?
I almost made a recommendation. Do you know what a pickleback is?
Is that like Nickelback?
The best band,
No, a pickleback is when you take a shot of whiskey and a shot of pickle juice back to back. And it sounds disgusting, but it is delicious. But it's not a thing that, you know, one frequently wants to just like take a shot of whiskey at home.
You know? Are you kidding? What have you been doing this whole quarantine?
Drinking plenty, but and I don't want. I never want to do shots. But so you can. I looked it up. You can do a pickleback, like
a pickleback of funk. Yeah.
So basically, it's 2 shots of whiskey, 3/4 of an ounce of lime juice, and a little bit of pickle juice, and it basically tastes like a tangy margarita, and that is a real treat as well. So if you have a lot of pickle juice laying around, a pickleback cocktail is the way to go.
Cool. That's. I just took the jar of bread and butter pickle juice
and just
started drinking it. And I was like, this is so good.
It is delicious.
What was the book?
Oh, yeah. It's a friend of mine's book, disclosure, but this dude named Sopan Deb is a writer for the New York Times, just wrote a book called Missed Translations, which is about his reconnecting with his family. It's also a first gen, brown kid story. And, you know, a trip he takes to India to reconnect with his family, who he didn't really know. And I really enjoyed the, I feel like I've sort of been in, you know, pigeonholed now as directing like musicals and brown shows and reading about this. But I'm like, yeah, what a great story. It's just wild.
Sounds good, man. That sounds great.
Yeah, right? it's just cool to see these stories being told more publicly now. Especially like, you know, the magic thing about Never Have I Ever to me is that it's, people are not freaking out so much and being like, oh my God. You know, like a brown kid is normal, you know?
Right.
It's just like kind of is normal. It was not when we were growing up. You know what I mean? Trust me, I know I was there.
Sure.
But like that kind of, it's really cool to see. It's maybe not as exciting as the pickle juice or the apple core, which now I kind of want to get one. We did also, we just ordered curtains, which I'm very excited about. Got a curtain rod. Just got delivered while we were talking.
Oh man, congratulations.
Wow. Yeah, it's curtains for us. Very excited. Yeah.
Cool.
Well, Kabir, this is such a treat. Come back anytime, you know, let us know when you got a new show to promote and
awesome guys.
This is awesome, man. Yeah,
it was great talking to you guys.
If you want to learn about all the things that we talked about on the show, you can visit justshootitpod.com. We're across all social media at justshootitpod, and I'm at Mr. Matt Enlow.
I'm at O Kaplan, and you should pretty much just follow me on Instagram, though I have been tweeting a lot, but not good tweets, so please do not follow me on Twitter. Our webmaster is Ewan Williams, and the music you're listening to is from the Free Music Archive and the artist Jazar. And leave us a rating on iTunes if you get a chance. Otherwise, we will see you next time. Thanks.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
it. Coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.